Welcome to episode number 28 of Calm History. This is a special holiday episode featuring history and trivia about reindeer. I'm Harris, and I created this time machine of tranquility to bring you the drama and excitement of history, but in a calm tone, so you can just chill and relax. Alright, in today's episode, I'm going to explore lots of history and trivia about real reindeer, such as, where do they live? Can you milk a reindeer? How do female reindeer differ from male reindeer? What are velvet antlers? What supplements are made from parts of reindeer? How many reindeer live in Lapland? And most importantly, what the heck is Lapland? I'm also going to explore lots of history and trivia about Santa's reindeer, such as, is Santa's sleigh actually pulled by reindeer or caribou? Do reindeer live at the true North Pole with Santa? When was the first historical evidence that Santa's sleigh was pulled by flying reindeer? Are Santa's reindeer male or female? Why do Santa's reindeer have weird names like Cupid, Blixen, and Donner? When and why was the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer written? And most importantly, are there any bizarre theories or hot conspiracies related to the history of Santa's reindeer? Spoiler alert, the answer is yes, and I created some of them myself in this episode. I think you'll find this special holiday episode to be educational, interesting, silly at times, and I'm even going to add a pinch of nutmeg and sass. Now, I originally wrote this episode just for my Silk Plus members. It was going to be my holiday treat to them, but I know this holiday time can be filled with lots of stress and sleepless nights. So I'm sharing this special holiday episode with everyone because I know, and you know, that your relaxation and sleep are important. So if you enjoy this episode, then treat yourself to a Silk Plus membership this holiday season, and you'll get free access for a limited time to every archive and bonus episode of Calm History, along with 500 other episodes. If interested, then just use the link in the episode notes or go to silkpodcasts.com. All right, lean back, close your eyes, and settle into my time machine of tranquility. I hope this episode distracts and relaxes your overactive brain squirrels. History and trivia about reindeer, including Santa's reindeer. Let's begin with two easy yet important questions. Question number one, are reindeer real? Yes, enough said. Question number two, are reindeer actually deer? The answer is yes. In this one, I do want to explain a little bit more, because I know that it probably doesn't sound surprising that reindeer are actually deer, but animal names are often misleading. Here are some fun examples is a mountain goat a goat? No, it's an antelope. Is a killer whale a whale? No, it's a dolphin. Is an electric eel an eel? No, it's a fish. Is a horned toad a toad? No, it's a lizard. Is an American buffalo a buffalo? No, it's a bison. Is a koala bear a bear? No, it's a marsupial. Yeah, see what I mean? Animal names are confusing. But you liked those, didn't you? You want to hear a few more? I love these. Is a ladybug a bug? No, it's a beetle, which is not a true bug. Is a firefly a fly? No, it's also a beetle, and also not technically a bug. Is a mantis shrimp a shrimp? No, and it's also not related to the praying mantis insect. Is a king cobra a cobra? No, and it's also not a king. Is a honey badger a badger? No, and it's also not made out of honey. Is a bear cat a cat? No, and it's also not a bear. And here are some obvious ones that you know are misnamed. Sea lions are not lions. Prairie dogs are not dogs. Sea cucumbers are not cucumbers. Starfish are not fish. Jellyfish are also not fish. Seahorses are definitely not horses. Hedgehogs are not hogs. And guinea pigs are not pigs. Wow, that was a tangent. Anyway, it's nice to know that reindeer are actually deer. Okay, I'll move on. What is the difference between reindeer and caribou? The answer is nothing. These are two words for the same general species. Now, within this general species, there are 19 types or subspecies of reindeer. Basically, whether you call them reindeer or caribou mostly depends on where they live or where you live. If you live in Northern Europe or Northern Asia, such as the Scandinavian countries or Northern Russia, then you tend to call these animals reindeer. An example of a subspecies of reindeer in Norway would be the Norwegian reindeer. If you live in the northern parts of North America, such as Alaska or Canada, then you tend to call these animals caribou. An example of a subspecies of reindeer in Canada would be the Newfoundland caribou. Okay, enough taxonomy mumbo jumbo. But let me hit you with a quiz question to see if you absorbed any of that taxonomic nerdery. Is Santa's sleigh pulled by reindeer or caribou? To know which exact subspecies of reindeer pulls Santa's sleigh, we need to know where Santa lives. And then we have to assume his reindeer are local reindeer. Yeah, this is going to get messier than a fruitcake shot out of a cannon. Let's tackle it. Where does Santa live? I know this sounds like an easy question, and I can hear you shouting the North Pole. But the true North Pole is not a geographic area. It's a geographic coordinate. It's the point in the northern hemisphere where the Earth's axis of rotation meets its surface. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. All you need to process from that is that the North Pole is a single point or coordinate. So yeah, you can go to the coordinate of the North Pole and say, look at me, I'm standing at the North Pole, and this is where Santa and his reindeer live. Keep in mind, though, that you would be standing on top of the Arctic Ocean, which will be covered with a huge, vast sheet of ice. So yeah, you can actually stand there and shout whatever you want without drowning. Which means, yeah, Santa and his reindeer could live on a sheet of ice on top of the Arctic Ocean. But let me ask you, if you were a reindeer, would you want to live on a vast, barren sheet of ice above the Arctic Ocean? Yeah, exactly. Neither would reindeer. They need green things to nibble, and green things grow best on land masses. The animals that you are most likely to see near the North Pole are those that get their food from the Arctic Ocean. Here are some local animals that would be very handy for Santa to use to pull his sleigh if he lived at the true North Pole. The first most logical option would be polar bears. These would be a great choice because they're so strong, but they may be a bad choice to pull Santa's sleigh because they may maul children on Christmas Eve. How about humpback whales? Yeah, they're very strong, and they don't eat children. But making these huge animals fly would take up way too much magic dust. How about seals or walruses? Ooh, no. These animals can be very noisy and cranky, and no one wants that on a long trip. How about penguins? They are so cute and adorable and would use a lot less magic dust to make them fly. Yeah, one problem. These small blobs of gelatin don't live near the North Pole. They live near the South Pole. Therefore, reindeer are clearly the best choice for Santa. They are strong, adorable, they don't eat children, and they live somewhat close to the North Pole. Now Santa has two options if he wants to use reindeer. Option number one, he can stay at the true North Pole and import his reindeer and their food. If he imported them from Europe, then they would be a reindeer subspecies. If he imported them from North America, then they would be a caribou subspecies. Now, importing reindeer and their food would be expensive, complicated, and potentially problematic because supply chains can go wonky. Let's consider option number two. Santa moves away from the true North Pole and lives on a northern landmass where reindeer already live. Sure enough, there are lots of places all over the world that claim to be the home of Santa Claus, and they even call themselves the North Pole. But I'm ignoring all those claims, and I'm tackling this mystery from a natural history perspective that is focused on Santa's most important resource, his reindeer. And the better we understand real reindeer, the better we can figure out the best home for Santa, which will also determine the exact subspecies he probably uses. Now, caribou subspecies in North America tend to be mostly wild and untamed, but reindeer subspecies in Europe or Asia tend to be partially domesticated. This means that harnessing a sleigh with domesticated reindeer in Europe or Asia would be so much easier. So if Santa doesn't want an antler where the sun doesn't shine, and nobody wants that, then Santa is moving to Northern Europe or Asia. That leaves a lot of options. But there is one area in Europe that is well known for using domesticated reindeer for over 500 years. That place is Lapland. Which brings us to our next big question. What the heck is Lapland? Lapland is an older term for the region of Sapmi, which spans over the northern parts of Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. It's estimated that there may be almost 1 million reindeer in Lapland. Some say that reindeer are to Lapland what sheep are to New Zealand. You basically can't swing a candy cane without hitting a reindeer in Lapland. Now, almost all of these reindeer are not wild, but rather, they are partially domesticated animals that are parts of herds owned by the local people. This tradition of reindeer herding in Lapland goes back to the 1500s. Having a herd of reindeer helped the local people in Lapland to survive by providing milk, cheese, meat, fur, and yes, you guessed it, power for pulling sleighs. I found this quote about reindeer herding in a book that was published in 1732. Here's what it said. The riches of the Laplanders consist in the number of their reindeer. The poorest people have from 50 to 200 reindeer. The middle class have from 300 to 700 reindeer, and the rich possess about 1,000 reindeer. I'll be doing a bonus episode soon that will describe what it was like to live in Lapland in 1850 and care for reindeer, including how they milked their reindeer. You can visit the area of Lapland today, or Sapmi, and experience lots of reindeer farms, reindeer safaris, reindeer parks, and of course, reindeer sleigh rides. And yes, you can also drink reindeer milk and even eat reindeer cheese. Be careful though. The Finnish area of Lapland love their reindeer so much that it's against the law to disturb the reindeer or frighten them in any way. So climbing on their backs and yelling, "Take me to Santa," may land you in jail, as it should. Anyway, the point is that Santa and his reindeer probably live someplace in Lapland because they have a rich history of domesticated reindeer. Another benefit of Lapland is that there are a lot of mountains, so Santa can easily hear if children are being good or bad. And as they say in northern Russia, Santa and the KGB are always listening. No, they don't say that. I just made that up to amuse myself. Okay, let's move on to other interesting stuff. Like, when did Santa first start using reindeer? And how did Santa's reindeer get their names? Let's begin with some basic facts. Reindeer have existed for about 2.6 million years. In the origins of Santa Claus, Father Christmas, and Saint Nicholas started about 2,000 years ago. Yet, the history of Santa using reindeer to pull his sleigh only started about 200 years ago. Yeah, I ran the math on that. That means for about 1,800 years, the poor guy must have pulled or pushed his large sleigh of gifts all by himself. And then one day, finally, after slipping a disc or pulling another hammy, he probably said, "There must be a better way." So when did Santa finally start using reindeer? The first evidence of Santa's sleigh being pulled by reindeer is from 1821. In this year, an anonymous poem was published in New York City. It was filled with 8 colorful illustrations, and it was titled, "Old Santa Claus with Much Delight." Now, here's a fun fact. The illustrations in this poem were the first instance of lithography in the United States. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what lithography is either, but this is a history podcast, so I feel compelled to sprinkle in some hot historical facts like that. The real juicy bit of this poem is that one of the illustrations shows Santa Claus sitting in a sleigh, which is being pulled by one reindeer. Yeah, I said one reindeer. This was probably just his first prototype. You know, test things out with one reindeer. If all goes well, then scale it up. It's just a basic business principle. This historical poem is pretty short, and it has some curious info, so I'll read it to you. Here are the first 2 lines, which confirm that there is one reindeer. "Old Santa Claus, with much delight, his reindeer drives this frosty night." The words "his reindeer drives" confirms what the picture is showing. It confirms it is one reindeer. Otherwise, it would have stated, "his reindeer drive." So yeah, one tiny reindeer pulling a massive sleigh of presents. You gotta start somewhere. The next 2 lines of the poem confirm that the reindeer can fly. Here they are. "Over chimney tops and tracks of snow to bring his yearly gifts to you." So the words "over chimney tops" indicate that the reindeer is not just pulling the sleigh. This one reindeer is flying the sleigh. The next 4 lines of the poem explain that this happens on Christmas Eve. Here they are. "The steady friend of virtuous youth, the friend of duty and of truth, Each Christmas Eve, he joys to come, where peace and love have made their home. This is actually the first historical reference to modern Santa Claus visiting homes on Christmas Eve. The next four lines of the poem explain that Santa sees some nasty stockings. It's kind of funny. Listen closely. Here it is. Through many houses he has been, and various beds and stockings seen, some white as snow and neatly mended, others that seemed for pigs intended. Oh my, my. It seems that Santa has to deal with some nasty and smelly stockings. The next four lines of the poem explain that Santa only gives out toys that are safe for children. Here it is. To some I gave a pretty doll, to some a peg top or a ball. No crackers, cannons, squibs or rockets to blow their eyes up or their pockets. The four items that he lists all contain gunpowder. So, yeah, Santa avoids lawsuits by not giving out gifts that maim children. Pretty smart. The next four lines explain how he rewards good children. Wherever I found good girls or boys that hated quarrels, strife, and noise, I left an apple or a tart or a wooden gun or painted cart. The next four lines highlight that his gifts are family-friendly and brain-friendly. No drums to stun their mother's ear, nor swords to make their sisters fear, but pretty books to store their mind with knowledge of each various kind. Now we get to the end of the poem, which takes a little bit of a dark turn. The last eight lines highlight the gifts he gives bad children. Get ready. This is grim. But where I found the children naughty, in manners crude, in temper haughty, thankless to parents, liars, swearers, boxers or cheats, or base tale bearers, I left a long, black birchen rod, such as the dread command of God directs a parent's hand to use when virtue's path his sons refuse. Did you get all that? If not, I'll summarize it for you. For bad children, Santa leaves a branch from a birch tree so their parents can beat them. Yikes. Luckily, though, the big thing that history has retained from this poem is that Santa's sleigh is pulled by a flying reindeer on Christmas Eve. Rather than, parents should beat their children on Christmas Day with a stick left by Santa. Okay, now we can move on to the origin of the names of Santa's reindeer. It's likely that the prior poem, written in 1821 and published in New York City, was read by another man who also lived in New York City at this same time. His name was Clement Moore, and in 1823, a Christmas poem he wrote was published in a New York newspaper. His poem was titled, A Visit from St. Nicholas. You may know this poem better by the title, the night before Christmas, or 'twas the night before Christmas, which is the first line of the poem. I'm sure you know this poem, so I'll just focus on the portion with Santa's reindeer. Compared to the prior Christmas poem, Moore's poem made two major changes to the reindeer. The first major change is that the number of reindeer were boosted from 1 to 8. Thank goodness. And the other major change is that the reindeer have names. Here are the original words from that portion of the original poem. But do notice that the first line uses the word coursers, which is just an old term for fast horses. Okay, here it is. More rapid than eagles, his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted, and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Dunder and Blixem. Now, some of that might have sounded a little bit different from what you know today, but don't worry. I'll unravel the original names of these reindeer. Unfortunately, Moore never provided any deep explanations for why he used those exact names. In general, the names of the reindeer do follow the tradition of naming animals after their natural or ideal attributes. For example, Fido is a popular historical name for a dog because Fido is short for fidelity, and that means faithful, which is a common and ideal attribute of a dog. So now we can look at the name of each reindeer to see if it might reflect an ideal attribute for a flying reindeer. The first reindeer name is Dasher. This name was probably chosen because it means someone or something that is fast. You also know this word from a very popular Christmas song that was published in 1850. It begins, "Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh." Yeah, the song is Jingle Bells, and dashing means to move quickly. So, Dasher is a good name for a flying reindeer. The second reindeer name is Dancer. Dancers are agile and coordinated. Yeah, this is an important attribute for a flying reindeer. This name also makes sense. The third reindeer name is Prancer. To prance means to spring from the hind legs and is often used to describe the movement of horses. It generally means to move lightly or to move in a lively manner. Yeah, those are also important attributes for a flying reindeer. The fourth reindeer name is Vixen. A common but older use of this word is to describe a fierce or spirited woman. It also can refer to a female fox, and foxes are considered agile and intelligent. So the name may reflect the attributes of being fierce, agile, and intelligent. Key traits I know I would want in my flying reindeer. but why a term that is mostly associated with females? Well, are you assuming that Santa's reindeer are males? They could all be males, they could all be females, or they could be a mix. I'll explain more about the reindeer gender in a bit. I'll finish these names first. The fifth reindeer name is Comet. The word comet, to describe something that streaks through the sky, has been around for about 2,000 years. So yeah, you want your flying reindeer to streak through the sky. So Comet is also a very logical name. The sixth reindeer name is Cupid. Cupid is the ancient Roman god of love. Helping Santa to disperse gifts to children around the world is an act of love. So that part makes sense. Cupid is also often depicted as a baby or small child with wings. So being named after a winged god who spreads love also makes sense for a flying reindeer. And now we get to the last two reindeer. The names of the seventh and eighth reindeer names were changed several times. They started as Dunder and Blixem, which were colloquial New York Dutch, which meant thunder and lightning. Moore later changed them to Donder and Blitzen, probably because Blitzen paired better with Vixen. Later, once again, the name Donder got changed in the song Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Donder and Blitzen became Donner and Blitzen, which are German for thunder and lightning. This may have helped the flow and ease of saying these two names. Donner and Blitzen does seem easier to say than Donder and Blitzen. Regardless, having two flying reindeer named after thunder and lightning also makes great sense to me. Now, let's tackle the gender of these reindeer. First off, Moore's poem never reveals the gender of the reindeer. The only pronouns used for the reindeer are the gender-neutral terms they and them. The reindeer could be males, females, gender neutral, or a mix of all of these options. If you dig around the internet for the answer, almost every website that dives into this question concludes the reindeer are all female. The science behind their logic is pretty good, but most of these sites overlook several other alternate explanations. Let me explain why these websites believe all the reindeer are female, and then I'll point out what they overlook. These websites all refer to the illustrations that often accompany Moore's poem. Those illustrations show eight reindeer with large, beautiful antlers pulling Santa's sleigh on Christmas Eve. Based on the biology of reindeer, that would mean that the reindeer are probably female. I'll explain. In almost every species of deer, only the male deer grow antlers. There is only one exception. Yeah, reindeer. Both male and female reindeer grow antlers. Both genders need them to shovel snow off of grass and plants so they can access and eat them during the winter. Both genders will also use their antlers to defend themselves or to defend that fine patch of grass they just uncovered from the snow. To grow their antlers, they initially grow velvet antlers, which are soft and flexible. These growing velvet antlers are basically rubbery because they're made out of cartilage. Over time, the cartilage will be replaced by bone and will feel like the stone-hard antlers that you are familiar with. This same process happens to your bones. When you were born, your bones were mostly cartilage. But as you grew, those flexible cartilage templates were slowly replaced with solid bone. The growing antlers are called velvet antlers because they have a velvet-looking coating on them during this growth phase. This velvet coating is rich in blood vessels to bring nutrients and oxygen to the growing antlers. When the antlers are finished growing and calcifying into hard bone, that velvet coating is shed or rubbed off. Let me share a quick consumer product warning related to velvet antlers. You may see some supplements for sale that are made from velvet antlers. They claim that ingesting their velvet antler supplement will make you bigger, better, stronger, and faster. But ingesting the cartilage from a growing antler will not boost your performance in any way. What some of these companies do is they illegally add testosterone, growth hormone, or some other drug to the cartilage. They know that you're someone who doesn't want to use dangerous drugs to boost your performance. So rather, they want you to falsely think that the velvet antler product is a natural way for you to boost your performance. But it's not. Unfortunately, many professional athletes get tricked. They test positive for a banned substance, and then they wonder what happened. Let's get back to the gender mystery of Santa's reindeer. A key difference between male reindeer antlers and female reindeer antlers is when they fall off. Male reindeer usually drop their huge antlers after the mating season in the fall, around November. Yeah, that's about a month before Christmas. On the other hand, female reindeer usually drop their antlers after giving birth, which is several months after Christmas. Based on that typical and accurate biology, most websites conclude that Santa's reindeer must be female. Why? Because the illustrations show reindeer with antlers on Christmas Eve, and that could only be female reindeer. Now, let me tackle all the alternate explanations that they fail to mention. Possibility number one. Although rare, some male reindeer do retain their antlers until after Christmas. So biology doesn't exclude the possibility that all of Santa's reindeer with antlers are males. I do think, though, that this is a weak point. Let's move on to a more likely situation. Possibility number two. In Lapland and other areas that do reindeer herding, they often castrate the male reindeer. This makes them easier to handle and results in the male reindeer retaining their antlers past Christmas. So some or all of Santa's reindeer could be castrated males. Yeah, it's grim, but it is possible. Possibility number three. As I mentioned before, Moore's poem about the eight reindeer never said they were male or female. The poem also never said if they had antlers or not. When Moore first shared his poem publicly in 1823, it was just text. There were no illustrations. Even later, in 1844, he published a book of his poems, which included A Visit from St. Nicholas. And once again, he didn't include any illustrations of the reindeer. This means that Moore, the author of the big famous poem, never stated or illustrated that his reindeer had antlers. Every illustration that shows reindeer with antlers next to his poem was drawn by someone else and added to his poem by the editor of the newspaper or book that was printing or reprinting his poem. This could mean that Moore's vision of his flying reindeer was that they didn't have antlers. Think about it. Would antlers be beneficial or detrimental to flying reindeer? Yeah, 100% detrimental. Go ahead, name a single flying animal that has antlers. There are none. Zip. Zilcho. Antlers would add a lot of extra weight. And even worse, the antlers would greatly increase the animal's drag coefficient. Any illustrator who has drawn a flying reindeer with antlers just doesn't understand basic aerodynamic principles. So this means that Santa's reindeer in Moore's original poem could all be males and without antlers. And now for the final and fourth possibility that I've come up with. And this one is my favorite option. It blends together several different things that I've explained so far. I think Moore envisioned that Santa's reindeer were a mix of males and females. He wanted some non-castrated male reindeer that dropped their antlers before Christmas. He wanted the male reindeer to be aggressive for pulling the sleigh, but also aerodynamic for flying. And then the name of Vixen is a big clue that at least one is female. As I said before, Vixen means fierce, agile, and intelligent. In the world of dog sledding, being fierce, agile, and intelligent are the key traits of your lead dog. So yeah, I think Vixen was the lead reindeer in Moore's poem. But what about her big antlers? In the world of pro cycling, domestiques are cyclists who purposely ride in front of other team members. They do this to break the wind and reduce the drag coefficient for those behind them. Some of the best domestiques in history have been quite tall compared to other cyclists. This may be because they block more wind for the riders behind them. Likewise, Vixen's antlers at the front would increase her effort, but it would decrease the effort for every reindeer behind her. All right, now that I've made a hot mess out of all of that, let's move on to our final reindeer, Rudolph, who's also referred to as the ninth reindeer. The creation of Rudolph begins in the 1930s with the Montgomery Ward department stores. Every Christmas, Montgomery Ward had been buying and giving away coloring books to their customers. In 1939, they decided to create their own book to give away in order to save money. It wouldn't be a coloring book, though, but rather a well-illustrated Christmas-themed book for children. To create this book, they hired a man named Robert May. May went to his office, sat down, and stared out of his office window in downtown Chicago. He claims to have seen a thick fog roll into the city, which gave him his core idea. The story would be about a reindeer with a bright nose that would shine through the fog to help Santa. May also stated that he was bullied as a child, so he gave the reindeer a backstory of being mocked for having a bright nose. He wrote his story as a poem, and he titled it Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. During the 1939 holiday season, Montgomery Ward distributed 2.4 million copies of May's poem. 9 years later, in 1948, May enlisted his brother-in-law to turn his poem into a song. And 1 year after that, it was sung by Gene Autry and later by Bing Crosby, helping it to become the popular Christmas song that you know today. Now, let's tackle some questions that you may have, like, does Rudolph have antlers around Christmas Day? In the 1938 poem written by May, the illustrations in his book do show Rudolph with small antlers. I know your next question. Is Rudolph referred to as being a male or female? In the 1938 poem and in the 1948 song, the pronouns of he, him, or his are used to refer to Rudolph. So what does all this mean? Yep, you guessed it. Rudolph is a castrated male reindeer. That is the best explanation for his pronouns, his antlers around Christmas, and his smaller size compared to other reindeer. One more question. Can reindeer have red noses? Yeah, sort of. Reindeer do have extra blood vessels in their noses to deal with the cold air. These extra blood vessels bring more blood, which brings more heat, and it makes their noses look more red. So, on very cold nights, or when they are very physically active, like flying through the air, some reindeer may appear to be red-nosed. Alright, now I want to open a can of worms to say that May's 1938 poem about Rudolph may not be as creative as it may seem. Point number one. He often explained that being bullied as a child influenced his backstory for Rudolph. But in some interviews, he also admits that the famous story of the ugly duckling was a big influence for Rudolph's rough childhood. So, I do think he leaned quite heavily on the success and inspiration of the famous ugly duckling story to give Rudolph the backstory that he did. Point number two. May's 1938 poem about Rudolph borrows quite heavily from Moore's 1823 poem about Christmas, you know, the one titled A Visit from St. Nicholas, or 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. Here is the start to Moore's 1823 poem. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. Now listen to the start of May's 1938 poem about Rudolph, written over 100 years later. 'Twas the day before Christmas, and all through the hills, the reindeer were playing, enjoying their spills. Not only does May use almost the exact same starting words, but he copies the same rhyming pattern as Moore's poem. Granted, though, many people did this with their poems, and Moore didn't really invent that style of rhyme. Anyway, let's also compare the way these two poems end. Here is the end to Moore's 1823 poem. But I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight, "Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night." And here is the end to May's 1938 poem about Rudolph. You may hear them call as they drive out of sight, "Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night." Is it reverence and dedication to the great 1823 poem? Or is it just lazy writing by an uninspired author? I'll let you decide. And now, for my final point about the original story about Rudolph. Borrowing a little from the ugly duckling story and a little from the Visit from St. Nicholas poem are not really that big of a deal. Ultimately, though, May created his own unique theme. His unique story is about a sad, insecure individual who didn't have any confidence and self-worth until Santa came along, recruits him to his North Pole team, and gives him a valuable purpose. Here is my big problem with all of that. That unique theme was already the core component of another popular story that was widely published before May wrote his Rudolph poem. The story was titled Jimmy Scarecrow's Christmas. It's about a scarecrow who feels sad, lonely, and useless during winter. Until one day, Santa Claus comes along and gives him a special job. Santa brings Jimmy Scarecrow to the North Pole so he can scare away Arctic explorers. This new purpose brings Jimmy Scarecrow great joy and confidence. Now, doesn't that sound a lot like the core theme of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? The story of Jimmy Scarecrow's Christmas was published in the Children's Book of Christmas Stories in 1913, which is 26 years before Robert May published his story about Rudolph in 1939. The author, Mary Wilkins Freeman, was a prolific, award-winning, and well-known author in her time. So it is very likely that Robert May had read her story about Jimmy Scarecrow. So, do I really think that May's story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is just horrible plagiarism? Nah, I'm just having a little bit of fun. The real point from these examples is that history is always iterative. You add to the efforts of those before you, and then those after you will do the same. That's just how history works. Okay, that ends my deep dive into reindeer and some of the mysteries of Santa's reindeer. This is the end of the episode. I hope you enjoyed this special holiday episode of Calm History. If you'd like to become a Soak Plus member and get free access for a limited time to all the archive and bonus episodes of Calm History and 500 other episodes, then just use the link in the episode notes or go to silkpodcasts.com. Thank you for listening to my podcast. Calm History is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to enjoy more podcasts like The Constant, Underworld, and Subtext.